Good day, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradoxes Sunday School class. Dr. Ross is with us today. He's going to be talking about astrophysics of cancer. So it's a health subject. He started last week. He'll be on part two today. For the next 2 weeks, he will be gone, and our own Dave Sargent will be up here. Truth in the Bible, accuracy of the Bible, it's the same subject. Dave continued with that. So please try to be here for that one. And treats, we got a lot of good treats. Thank you for everybody that brought those and set up the tables. We have a new, Reasons to Believe has a new book. They do their own publishing now. So this is called Clear Thinking in a Messy World, A Christian Guide to Logic, Reason, and Cognitive Bias. Well, RTB scholars Kenneth Samples and Mark Perez wrote the book. So if you're a philosophy buff, or if you just like anything like this, get it. You can get it online, rtb.org, or through Amazon or wherever books are sold. And with that, let me say a short prayer. Maybe not too short here. Let's bow our heads. Lord, we pray for your blessings on this gathering. Please bring our fellow Americans in the eastern states. Help them, Lord, with us to overcome the devastation of Hurricane Helene. And bring comfort for the victims. Bless Israel and the situation in the Mideast. Bless Dr. Ross. Give him great healing and health, that he may continue serving you here on earth. Bless us that we will gain great insight into the wonders of your creation. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Come on up, Dr. Ross. Please welcome him.
Again, I would commend you this book, Clear Thinking, written by Ken Samples, our staff philosopher, and Mark Perez, who is now the Chief Operating Officer at Reasons to Believe. And let me just say a word about Mark Perez. There was a Pasadena City police officer that used to be regular in this class, Jack Knabel, also known as Crazy Jack, because Jack would volunteer to go into the most dangerous parts of Pasadena while he was on the police force. And he was a Christian. But the Pasadena Police Force teamed him up with this atheist, Mark Perez. And Mark was raised in a family where his father was an atheist physicist. And his father said, hey, I want to train you to be the best atheist that's here in America. And so Mark grew up with this training in how to defend scientific atheism. But he was teamed up with Jack Knabel. And the two of them would go into these places. They'd be arresting these really violent criminals, throw them into the back of the car. And while they're driving to the Pasadena jail, Jack would start talking to the person in the back and saying, if you continue this lifestyle, I think you've got a good idea where you're going to wind up. And the criminal in the back said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, you're going to be spending a lot of time in incarceration, and you're going to be with some very unpleasant people. They're going to do to you what we just now arrested you for doing. But there is a way out. And he began to share the gospel with them and basically said, we're all sinners. So I'm a sinner just like you. And we're all in need of redemption. And as he continued to talk, Mark would turn around and look at this really violent criminal, and tears would be rolling down his eyes. And he'd be listening. And then basically saying, tell me, Jack, what do I need to do with my life? And so Jack would pray the sinner's prayer, lead him to Christ. And then Jack would say, I'm going to find out what cell you're in. I'll be visiting you on a daily basis. And this happened over and over again. So Mark was quite surprised by what he was seeing happening in the back seat of his police car. And then Jack turned to him and said, Mark, why are you not a follower of Jesus Christ? And he says, well, because of science. Science basically proves that there can't possibly be a God. And then Jack said to Mark, well, have you ever talked to a real science? And my father is a scientist. He's a physicist. I mean, have you ever talked to a scientist who actually believes that the Bible is the inspired and errant word of God and that Jesus is the Savior that's being offered to all of humanity? He says, I don't think such a person exists. So Jack said, well, I want you to come to a class with me. So Mark started coming to the class. He came just once and he said, I've never heard this stuff before. And so he was intrigued enough to come back. He came back several times. And it took 3 months, but he gave his life to Jesus Christ right here in the Paradoxes class. So, and he's now serving, by the way, he went on to the LAPD and got promoted 10 times. He was actually offered to be the chief of police for the LAPD, but he said, I don't want to get into the politics. So he remained as the, they have like three positions. But because he turned down the job, they said, we're going to give you the job of disciplining all the police officers that are in need of discipline. It was a job nobody wanted. So, but he saw that as an opportunity to minister to all these police officers that needed to build some Christian character in their lives. So, and he wound up getting a master's degree in the history and philosophy of science, got a second master's degree in business administration, which explains why he got promoted so many times. And I remember when our board of directors was saying, how much experience have you had managing people? Because we're considering you to manage 40 people here at Reasons to Believe. He says, what's the greatest number of people I've ever managed? And he says, 18,000. So I said, well, I think that's adequate. So, but no, he's been doing well. And now he's really at a point where he's been able to deliver enough management expertise at Reasons to Believe. He's got time to do what he really loves, which is, you know, integrating philosophy, science, and the Christian faith. So that's Mark. He wrote all the chapters in the book on cognitive biases and how just the biases and the fallacies that we all struggle with often hinders us in properly interpreting. And he says, that's my testimony. I came towards Christianity with all kinds of personal biases that basically darken my eyes to the truth. So that's Mark. This is the second of a two-part series on integrating the physical sciences with the health sciences. As I mentioned last week, I'm actually part of an international team of medical researchers where we're bringing out a series of books on the amazing designs of the human body and how that points us to Christ and basically affirms what the Bible says about medical science. One book is already out, two more are being planned. And you can get a recording of last week's message, which was on the problem of air pollution and how that's giving us a health crisis that can be relatively straightforwardly solved by the nations of the world. So that was last week. Today I'm going to be talking, as announced, about the astrophysics of cancer. And just to begin, I want to know how many of you have ever had to struggle with cancer. Okay, I have. Okay, a few of you have. Okay, that's actually a testimony to good health care. In a nation where you got good health care, you have a higher percentage of people that have to deal with cancer, because you're not dying or getting crippled by somebody, some other health issue. If you live long enough and you live a healthy enough lifestyle, you will inevitably run into cancer. So if you're a cancer survivor, that's actually a testimony to God's grace and God's design. Now, how many of you actually know somebody who has had to deal and treat their cancer? Okay, see, everybody. We all know somebody who's had to deal with that. Now, I grew up in a family where our extended family, there's no cancer. They live into their 90s, and they don't get cancer, with the exception of my immediate family. And the thing about our immediate family is we were raised in a home where we got exposed to a lot of lead and a lot of asbestos. And so my father died of a cancer as a result of exposure to asbestos. My mother battled cancer for 26 years. Both of my sisters have had cancer. My older sister, she just called me and says, I got a new cancer. So this is her second bout with cancer. And I personally have had two bouts with cancer. So 15 years ago, I had to have my prostate removed. And yeah, it's interesting how the medical doctor says, your PSA is up a little bit. You know, there's about a 2% chance that there might be some cancer in your prostate. You better do a biopsy. They did the biopsy and they said, you got an aggressive cancer there. You're not only in the 2% category, it says, in fact, they wouldn't even do surgery on me until they did a full body scan. They wanted to be assured that the cancer hadn't spread before they were going to treat me. Fortunately, they said, okay, you're cancer-free. But they also said, we would encourage you to get surgery as soon as possible. So I signed up to get the surgery. They said, well, we've been opening in 5 weeks. Well, I got a phone call the next day saying, can you come in today? We've had a cancellation. I said, I'll come in today. The surgeon took out my prostate and he said, we checked the prostate. If you'd waited those 5 weeks, it would have been too late. So I'm grateful for that cancellation. So you can see the hand of God there. And they said, 95% of the time, you're going to be cancer-free. There won't be any prostate issues. But they said occasionally, when we take the prostate out, a few cancer cells escape. And about 10 or 15 years later, they begin to multiply. So they said, there's about a 5% risk that'll happen in your case. Well, I was in the 5% category. So 5 years ago, I had to go through 38 rounds of radiation to take care of the reappearance of the cancer. Okay, come January, I'm going to be tested again to see if that cancer has come back. And they said, if it comes back undetectable, we're going to declare you cancer-free. So that's good news. I'm waiting for the final test on that. However, a few months ago, I had blood in my urine. And so I called the cancer doctors at City of Hope, and they said, you definitely have scar tissue in your bladder from the radiation, and that's why you got the blood. So we're going to have to start testing you for bladder cancer. So every 6 months, I go in to be tested for that. But I'm not worried because they got a new way of treating bladder cancer. You won't believe this. You know what they do when you get bladder cancer? They pump tuberculosis into your bladder. The TB kills the cancer. And once the cancer is killed, they kill the TB. On the assumption that you don't have one of those strains of TB that are not so nice. So there are still some risks. But I'm hoping that, bladder cancer won't be an issue. But hey, I'm in my 70s. This is not unusual for people who make it into their 70s, 80s, and 90s, that they got to deal with all these things. So, but that's part of the message I want to share with you. And, unfortunately, I'm going to come across as an astrophysicist, which means that, you're going to get a lot of facts and probably not that much empathy and compassion, because I don't really have the time to develop that. I really want to give you the facts. And I can tell you this, every time I've had to deal with cancer with different doctors and nurses, it gives me an opportunity to share my faith. And I just want to, and I tell about this in my book, Always Be Ready. Hospitals are one of the best places where you get opportunities to share your faith. Every time I've been in the hospital, I've been able to share my faith. In fact, in my first cancer treatment, I was at Huntington in Pasadena, and the nurse was prepping me, and she immediately recognized me. Oh, you're Hugh Ross. So evidently, and she was from the Philippines. She'd heard about me in the Philippines. So she says, let me gather together all the Christian nurses here. So I had about 10 Christian nurses surrounding me, and they prayed for me in front of the surgeon. And the surgeon wasn't a believer. But he was so impressed that all these people came to just pray. And he was listening to the prayers. He was talking to me and says, I want to wheel you into the operating room. And the nurse turned to me and says, he's never done that before. But he wanted to talk to me about what he was hearing about science and Christianity. So I get into the operating theater, and this is really interesting. He says, I'd never done this before, but I'm going to be doing the surgery robotically. And you're a scientist. Let me demonstrate this instrument before I cut you up. So he turned all the switches on, and I got to see all these scalpels coming down from the ceiling. He says, five of them are going to go into you. That's where we put cameras inside of you. And then this is the one that really does the damage. It's a little bigger scalpel. That's how we're going to take out the prostate. So he says, you're the only patient I had that wouldn't be freaked out by this. So I was asking questions about the thing and then saying, you know, I really appreciate the fact you're doing this robotically. There's not going to be a human being around me. He's going to be 40 feet away, not on a gown, just in a shirt like this. He'll be playing on a computer. And he says, yeah, you know, we basically bathe you in ultraviolet radiation. There's no human around. You're not going to get an infection. We don't have to worry about infection. And he says, you're slim. This is normally a 4.5 hour surgery. I'm going to see if I can get it done in 1.5 hours. And he got it done in less than 90 minutes. So, and then we got to talk afterwards. So, if you ever get sent to a hospital, look for God to give you opportunities. Probably the most dramatic example, I don't know why I'm getting off on track on this, but probably the most dramatic example of this is, I think about it 17 years ago. Yeah. I was flying home from Australia where I'd been for 10 days, and I was flying economy. It's a 19-hour flight, and I was in the middle seat, so I wasn't really able to get up and move around. And come home, and my wife, Kathy, said, you don't look so good after your morning run. And I says, yeah, I wasn't able to do as well as I normally do. And she says, well, I think you better get a stress test just to make sure something isn't wrong. Well, I passed the stress test, but my wife noted, hey, you're not recovering. She went to the cardiologist and says, I don't care if my husband passed the stress test. I want you to do, what's that procedure where they put a angiogram? Says, I want an angiogram. Says, we never do that to anybody who passes a stress test. But she got really loud and she got very firm and said, I know my husband is not normal. Something's wrong with him. So I said, okay, we'll do the angiogram. And then the doctor came back bug-eyed and said, your widowmaker artery is blocked. We have to do surgery within the next few hours. Otherwise, you're going to die. So, and he said, have you been eating the wrong foods? And my wife looked at him and says, not that guy. So, because they were convinced that, I was going to have cholesterol in my arteries. They're going to check all the different arteries. But when they did the angiogram, they said, there's only one artery that's blocked. And so, but then they had to do surgery on me. And I was worried, you know, I was not in the best heart surgeon hospital, but they said, we're bringing somebody from USC. He does heart transplants. And I said, oh, he does heart transplants. I got a good surgeon. So he came in to visit me, big, powerful guy. He looked like he could be a weightlifter in the Olympics. And I said, he's going to have no trouble breaking my sternum. And he's probably going to do a nice, clean break. I probably won't have a bad scar or anything. This is great. So I would have felt a lot better about that. They did a bypass on me, one bypass. And again, they did it in record time. Because the surgeon found out, oh, you're a scientist. Then let's not put you on the heart-lung machine. I think I can do this surgery fast enough that we don't have to put you on the heart-lung machine. And that way, your brain will be intact. There'll be no possible damage. He says, I think I can do it that fast. Well, he did it really fast. It was done in less than 90 minutes. And then they wheeled me out of the surgery into the ICU. I get into the ICU, and there's over 40 nurses and doctors in the ICU. And they basically said, we've drugged you up. You're going to feel really good for the next 2 hours, and then you're not going to feel good at all. So can you give us a lecture on... we want to hear your lecture. We've heard you give lectures on physics and God and astronomy. Can you give us a lecture? And he says, well, I don't have my PowerPoint with me. So, but I gave a lecture there. We had a nice long Q&A time. And some of the people there were Christians, but most of them weren't. It was a wonderful outreach. You never know what God's going to do, and he gives you the opportunities. So, and there are many opportunities afterwards. Fat, I was in the hospital 4 days, and when I went in for the surgery, they said, is it okay if we have a chaplain come and visit you? And I said, oh yeah, that's fine. So I was in the ICU, and this chaplain comes in, and he starts talking to me, and I said, are you a follower of Jesus Christ? And he says, no, but I can read you a Bible passage if you like, and I can pray with you. And I said, well, why are you not a follower of Jesus Christ? He says, science. That's why I'm not a follower of Jesus Christ. Well, have you ever talked to a scientist who took the Bible seriously and was a serious... I don't think such a person exists. So I said, well, you're talking to one. And that opened up a nice conversation. And there was another gentleman who had the same... In fact, he had 4 bypasses, not just one. So he was there with me. I got visited by 5 chaplains. And 4 of them were not believers. The first 4 were not believers. Every one of them said the reason why they weren't believers, there's a conflict between science and the Bible. So I got to share with all of them. And the gentleman who was next to me in the bed, when that second chaplain came and said it's because of science, a big smile broke out on his face. He knew what was coming. And 2 more happened. Then chaplain number 5 walks into the room. That's on my last day. And I recognized him, because I did a long weekend conference for military and hospital chaplains up in Oregon, and he was there. So I said, oh, good to see you again. And he was a Bible-believing chaplain. And so I told him about my experiences, and he said, I've never heard of anyone ever getting more than 1 chaplain visit. No one's ever gotten 2, let alone 5. He says, I think this is the hand of God that you got 5. And he said, tell me the names of these 4. I'm going to take each one of them out to lunch. I'm going to follow up with them. And what books do you think I ought to give to them? So, again, you never know what God's going to do. I got a lot more stories. I'm going to stop there because we need to get into the astrophysics of a cancer. Okay. This all happened a year ago when I was in India with Reasons to Believe Asia Pacific. And the last event I did in India was to speak to 50 cancer surgeons, medical practitioners, and cancer researchers. And I said, well, why are you having me speak to them? I'm not a medical researcher. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a geneticist. And they said, well, why don't you talk about the astrophysics of cancer? I know you can link the two of them together somehow. So I wound up preparing a talk on that. And that, I felt good about that because I don't want to share with these researchers stuff they already know. So this is basically a redesign of the talk that I gave to them. I've added some content to it that I didn't give there in India. And I'm eager to do this because I want it recorded so we can distribute it to people that are interested in this topic. But let me begin with this Bible verse. John 16:33. In this world you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. So Jesus is basically saying the universe was designed to ensure that all of us go through tribulation. He's basically suggesting the tribulation we go through is a good thing, but he says it's not permanent. A time will come when you'll not face tribulation anymore. So that I've overcome this world, and for all of my followers, I'm going to take you into a new realm where there'll be no tribulation for the rest of eternity. Okay, now, as a physicist, I've come up with another translation of John 16:33. In this world, you'll have thermodynamics, electromagnetism, and gravity. But take heart, have overcome thermodynamics, electromagnetism, and gravity. We live in a world where everything in the universe is subjected to thermodynamics, gravity, and electromagnetism. And it's because of that we all go through tribulation. I mean, if you've got those laws of physics operating, your body's going to decay. Your car is going to decay. Your backyard is going to decay. Everything is going to decay. And you're going to have to do a lot of work to reverse the decay. I mean, that's what my wife tells me about yard work. You know, Hugh, go out there and reverse the decay. But that means I got to go through tribulation to reverse that decay. But what this implies is in a universe where you got thermodynamics, electromagnetism, physical cancer is inevitable. And so your cells are going to decay, which makes them more susceptible to cancer. You're being exposed to electromagnetic radiation. You know, my wife is also dealing with cancer, not the serious kinds I'm dealing with. It's skin cancer. I'm not dealing with skin cancer. Because of my childhood, I was raised in one of the rainiest parts of the world. And it was, you know, it's coastal British Columbia. It was far north and it was rainy, so I didn't get exposed to as much electromagnetic radiation damage as she got exposed to. If you're living here in Southern California and you're going outside without sunscreen, you're going to have your skin cells damaged to a point where they're more susceptible to cancer. Now you say, why would God subject us to thermodynamics, gravity, and electromagnetism, knowing it's going to put us through all this tribulation, knowing it means we're going to have a significant risk of getting cancer? Because that's physical cancer. God is far more concerned about the spiritual cancer. And we need a universe with thermodynamics, electromagnetism, and gravity in order for God to efficiently and rapidly eradicate the far worse cancer, the spiritual cancer of our sin. And so, the physical cancer risk that we're exposed to in no way compares to the spiritual cancer risk that we're all designed. And so God purposely designed the laws of physics that govern the entire universe as a tool in his hand for the ultimate eradication of all evil. Okay, how does this work? I'm going to give a very quick summary of this. If you want a more thorough description, it's in the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. The laws of physics are designed to restrain the expression of evil. They're also designed to prepare us for our future roles in the new creation. Okay, as a professor at a university, I tell my students, I'm going to be taking you through a regimen of tribulation. You'll experience tribulation at my hand as I teach this class. But that tribulation is going to prepare you for a rewarding career. And, you know, they all say, I'm in. I want the tribulation. In fact, what I've noticed about my best students, they say, we're not getting enough tribulation. Can you put us through some more suffering and tribulation so we can be better prepared for our future careers? My really good students actually enjoy the suffering and the tribulation. They see it as something that is actually fun and enjoyable. And I did too when I was a student. It's like, hey, bring it on. I really love this stuff. So that's the kind of attitude that Jesus wants us to have with the tribulation we go through, realizing in Romans 8:28, all things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to the purpose he's placed upon your life. Which means, hey, if you wind up getting cancer or heart disease or you wind up being abused by your fellow human beings, God's going to work it out in some way that you will actually see greater good coming from the tribulation that you went through. So, two purposes of the laws of physics. Restrain the current expression of evil and to prepare us for careers in the new creation. And something I've had to deal with on my social media, so many unbelievers think that what Christianity is promising in heaven, we all get to sit in clouds and play harps. No, that's not what the Bible teaches about the new creation. It's a place where we're going to be occupied in new careers, very challenging careers, but very rewarding careers. And so we're not going to be just sitting, twiddling our thumbs, or looking at art or playing arts. We're going to be involved in a very challenging and rewarding careers. As Paul said, you'll be teaching and judging the angels, and you'll be magistrates over everything I create in the new creation. You'll be busy, this is going to be challenging, and you need to get prepared. And so we need to look at our lives here on planet Earth. We're only here for 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years, very short time in which God is taking us through a rigorous program of training for our future careers. Now, how does the restraint of evil work? Well, we see this in Genesis chapter 3, where God tells Adam and Eve, now that you've chosen the path of evil, in proportion to the evil that you commit, you'll be experiencing more pain, more work, and you're going to waste more time. The latter part comes from Ecclesiastes. And we're biologically designed that we do not enjoy gratuitous pain, gratuitous work, or extra wasted time. And so the laws of physics basically motivate us, hey, avoid evil, pursue virtue, because if you do, there'll be less pain in your life, there'll be less work that you have to do, you'll waste less time, and so this acts as a powerful motivator, because all of us want a life with less pain, less work, and less wasted time. But in the process, we discover, even if we do our best, we can't quite avoid the expression of evil. We need external help. And, this is where God says, well, I'm prepared to do for you what you can't do for yourself. And hey, I'm reminded of a story. So let me digress again. I was at the University of Toronto taking a class from Carl Sagan. And Carl was talking about the only hope for humanity is that there's an extraterrestrial intelligent civilization. And if we can make contact with them and read their Encyclopedia Galactica, that will solve all the problems we human beings face. Because if they've been around longer than we have, they will have solved all the problems. We just have to read their book, and therefore we need to build all these giant radio telescopes, scour the heavens, and see if we can find this Encyclopedia Galactica. And I was in the second row, and I was sharing with my fellow graduate students, don't we already have an Encyclopedia Galactica? And isn't Carl's problem is that he's not willing to read that Encyclopedia Galactica that an intelligent extraterrestrial alien gave to us thousands of years ago? I didn't realize how good Carl's hearing was. He overheard me and says, I know exactly what you're talking about. Nobody can live up to the moral standard of that book. I said, that's exactly the message of that book. Nobody, no human, can live up to the moral standard that God asks us to live up to. And therefore, we need to go to God for what we can't do for ourselves. Sorry about the digression. I get tempted sometimes. Okay. And what we see in Romans 8:21 that really, I think, solidifies this, the creation was subjected to frustration by the will of the one who subjected it, that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. And so Paul is explaining here in Romans 8, the entire creation, the entire universe, is subject to this pervasive law of decay or corruption, depending on your English translation, but it's temporary. We will be delivered from this law of decay the moment when the full number of humans that God intends to redeem from their sin are in fact redeemed by his work and power. And when that happens, there will be no more decay. There will be no more death. As you read Revelation 21, no decay, no death, no crying, no tribulation, no tears, and also no electromagnetism. It says there will be no sun or stars because God himself will illuminate everything with light. In fact, everything will shine forth light. It's a realm where there's no shadows and no darkness because everything is illuminated with a new kind of a light, not electromagnetic light. And also it describes a structure in the new earth that violates the law of gravity, so no gravity. In fact, I think it's a realm with completely different definitions. Okay. Oh, what about this universe? We live in a universe where there's gravity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear forces. With that, it's guaranteed that cancer is going to be an issue. However, we happen to live on a planet 4.57 billion years after it was formed, where the cancer rate is the lowest possible in the universe, anytime, anywhere in the universe. So I'm going to explain this, why it is we happen to be living at the lowest cancer risk place and time in the entire universe. Okay, one reason that cancer is an issue, we're exposed to cosmic radiation. In fact, if you were to move from Los Angeles area to Colorado, Denver, Colorado, your cancer risk will go up. Because in Denver, you're exposed to a little bit more cosmic radiation than you are here when you live near sea level. And it's such that people in Denver, given equal health status elsewhere, they typically live 3 months less than people who live at sea level, because they're exposed to more cosmic radiation. And people say, well, Hugh, maybe one reason why you've been having to deal with cancer, look at all the flying you do. Well, when you're at 35 to 45,000 feet, you get exposed to more cosmic radiation. Now, that little thin aluminum piece that shields you helps, but still a lot of cosmic radiation comes through. Okay. The biggest source of cosmic radiation are black holes. Black holes and supernova eruptions. And this is actually an image of a supermassive black hole. This is a black hole in the center of the giant galaxy M87 in the Virgo cluster. It comes in at 6.5 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. So it's the biggest black hole that astronomers have been able to image. And it was only 4 years ago that astronomers had the technology to even image these supermassive black holes, because they're really tiny. And the only way we astronomers have been able to image them is we network 18 big radio telescopes all over the world, those radio telescopes that are able to observe at millimeter wavelengths. And basically what we do is we link these radio telescopes together to build a telescope that has the diameter of about 6,500 miles. So the Hubble Space Telescope is what, 3-some meters across. And even the Keck telescope in the mountains of Hawaii, they're 10 meters across. We're talking a telescope that is 10,000 kilometers across, a gigantic telescope. But only that telescope is able to image black holes. And only two black holes so far have been imaged, the one in the center of our galaxy and this one right here. Excuse me. Now you say, why do we need black holes? Well, most black holes form when two neutron stars are orbiting one another. So if you've got about half the stars in our universe are double, triple, quadruple stars. Our Sun is a single star without a partner star, but a lot of them have partner stars. And several of them is where the two stars orbiting one another both end up as neutron stars. And if they end up as neutron stars, they orbit one another, but because of how intense their gravity is, the orbits of the neutron stars decay, which means as they orbit one another, they get closer and closer together. And if you wait a few million years, they wind up getting so close together that they merge. And when two neutron stars merge together, they become a black hole. And then black holes merge to become bigger black holes. So that's how you get a black hole that's 6.5 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. It's basically millions of tiny black holes merging together to become a really big black hole. But when two neutron stars merge together to become a black hole, you get an intense shower of neutrons, very fast-moving concentrated neutrons, and it's that concentration of fast-moving neutrons that makes 1/4 of the elements in the periodic table. And three of those elements are essential for life. So if it wasn't for black holes, neutron stars forming to make black holes, there'd be no possibility of human beings. There'd be no possibility of any mammals, because you'd be missing three key elements that are necessary for life, advanced life, to exist. You'd also be missing a lot of elements that are essential for a high technology civilization. And so one quarter of the elements in the periodic table, they're there because of black holes, neutron stars forming to be black holes. And it's things like gold, tin, uranium, thorium, molybdenum, even some of the lighter ones. You'll die without molybdenum. You'll die without tin. They have to be at the just right levels. Too much molybdenum in your body will kill you. Too little will also kill you. It has to be just right. So we happen to live in a universe where we have just the right number and size of black holes to ensure we have the elements we need at the just right levels. Okay. But obviously, you don't want to be exposed to too many of these black holes. Now, here's another image of this galaxy that has this really gigantic supermassive black hole in it, M87. If you look towards the right, you can see that there's a jet coming out from the black hole. And if that jet were pointed towards us, we'd all be dead. Even though it's 53 million light years away, it's so intense that if the jet were pointed towards us, there would not be advanced life here. So it's not only a problem for that galaxy, it's a problem for galaxies all around it. Fortunately, the jet is pointed away from us. And because it's pointed away from us, we don't have a problem. And also, it's really far away. That yellow arrow points to our Milky Way galaxy, and that little red star you see there is M87. And what you notice about this map of our super galaxy cluster is that the clusters and groupings of galaxies that have these really big black holes, notice they're all far away from us, far enough away that they don't pose a risk. In fact, there is no super, super giant black hole anywhere within 50 million light years of us. And by the way, we live in the only super galaxy cluster in the entire universe where it's actually possible to have advanced life where you don't have any nearby big clusters of galaxies that would have these nasty black holes. And this is a map of our local group of galaxies. One of its unique features, it has only two big galaxies, our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy. All the other galaxies are dwarf galaxies. Now, the Triangulum galaxy looks big. It covers about two moon diameters in the sky, but it has very little mass. The Triangulum galaxy does not have a supermassive black hole. In fact, the third biggest galaxy in the local group is that little dot just below the Milky Way. That's the Large Magellanic Cloud. That's the third most massive galaxy in the Milky Way. But for some reason, we've not been able to detect a supermassive black hole. And we found no galaxy that's as massive as the Large Magellanic Cloud that doesn't have a black hole a million times the mass of our star, the Sun. In fact, these are the three galaxies that do have such a supermassive black hole. Our galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy, and M32. Okay, Andromeda, its supermassive black hole is 140 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. M32, the dwarf galaxy that accompanies the Andromeda galaxy, it comes in at 3.5 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. Our Milky Way galaxy, which weighs more than a trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun, just as massive as the Andromeda galaxy, we have a very tiny supermassive black hole. It's only 4.15 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. In fact, this is the best image we have to date of the black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy. Now, what's interesting about all three of these supermassive black holes, they were very active just a few million years ago, which would have been very problematic for cancer in human beings. All three of them right now are in an extremely quiet state. So quiet that we are not subject to a big cancer risk. Typically, these supermassive black holes are drawing into them with their gravity bodies the size of our moon, size of planets, size of Jupiter, even stars. And when that happens, you get deadly radiation pouring out from the supermassive black hole environs, so deadly we'd all be dying from cancer at 10 or 15 years of age. Right now, our Milky Way galaxy is consuming a diet of tiny comets and asteroids. And we see flares of radiation a few times a day, but the radiation levels are so low, it poses no cancer risk for us. The same thing's happening on the Andromeda galaxy. Even though its supermassive black hole is 35 times more massive, it too currently is on a starvation diet of only consuming tiny bodies. And the same thing is true of M32. And you say, has it always been this way? Not at all. So when we look at our own Milky Way galaxy, we see these two gigantic X-ray bubbles that are expanding, basically telling us 2 to 2.5 million years ago, there was our supermassive black hole in our galaxy consumed something the size of a planet, poured out this deadly radiation, and this is where it is now. Fortunately, the bubbles now are so big, they don't pose a radiation risk. But a million years ago, they did pose a radiation risk. And so I think this shows God's hand. He created us human beings at the ideal moment in the history of our local group. And the unusual thing about the local group, it's only got three supermassive black holes. They're all quite small, and they're all very quiet in this narrow window in which we live. Now, you can read a lot more about this in a paper I had published in a secular science journal, Black Holes as Evidence of God's Care. You put that into any search engine, you'll be able to find it. And, you know, again, I'll tell a quick story. Back in the 1990s, reasons to believe had only been around for a few years, and I remember talking to our science team saying, we need to publish in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And so I teamed up with an astrophysicist in South Africa, and we began to distribute a paper we had written on the fine-tuning of the universe, which demonstrates the existence of a God beyond space and time. And we sent it out to dozens of different journals in the United States and in Western Europe, and we got a letter back from all of them. You mentioned God in this paper. You can't do that in a scientific research paper. And I says, well, what if the science points you in that direction? And they said, no, we're not going to allow it. So then we submitted it to the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society. That's a journal in the United Kingdom. And they have what's called monthly notices, where they allow papers to be published on astrophysics. But their quarterly journal specializes on connecting philosophy and religion with astrophysics. And we said, well, of course, we'll submit the paper there. They have to accept it. And we got a letter back saying, well, if you were trying to connect Hinduism, no problem with astrophysics. Or if you're trying to connect Islam or Zoroastrianism or Buddhism, but you're trying to connect Christianity, you can't do that in this journal. So it kind of showed you the bias. So how do we get around that? Well, we eventually submitted it to a journal in Germany. And they don't publish in English, they publish in German. And we got a letter back from the editor saying, if you can translate your paper into German, we'll accept it. Because there's not enough Christians here in Germany for this to be an issue. So we don't have a problem connecting God with astrophysics. So we got it published in Germany. But we had to get a third author who is a Christian in Germany to translate our paper into German. So it's still available. You can read it if you're fluent in German. I think you'll enjoy it. We do have the English translation if you want to see it. But this paper, Black Holes as Evidence of God's Care, it's an Asian journal. In fact, they're headquartered in Beijing. And we notice that they actually allow you to connect God with science. And again, it's because, you know, Christianity is not such a controversial issue there as it is here, although in some places in China it definitely is. And so I submitted this paper, Connecting Black Holes to the Christian Faith, and I drew three reviewers, all of whom were astrophysicists and who were atheists. And two of the three wanted the paper rejected. Again, they said, you know, we don't think the connection's been made securely enough. The third reviewer said, I think this should be published. So, but this journal actually doesn't simply allow the reviewers to be secret. Typically with journals, their critique is secret and their identity is secret. In this journal, their identity is secret, but their critique is not secret. It's public. And so each of the three reviewers published their critique of my paper, and then the journal said, hey, you're the author, you get a chance to respond. So I responded to the three critiques, and then they went back to the three reviewers and said, you can respond to Hugh's response to your critiques. And actually allow as many as three back and forths, and they're all made public. Well, we only went through two back and forths. After the second back and forth, all three of them said, okay, we're going to let it be published. But what's wonderful about the article, you can read the article for free. They don't charge. You can read the reviewer's critiques for free, and you can read my responses for free. I love this journal because it actually shows you what happens when you allow Christians and non-Christians to have a written dialogue back and forth. And so, anyway, you can check it out. Okay, there's something else about our position. We happen to be in the local arm of our Milky Way galaxy. It's the smallest spiral arm in our Milky Way galaxy. It has the fewest places where stars are forming and where black holes are forming. So it's the safest spiral arm in our Milky Way galaxy. And then we're in what's called the local bubble along our local arm. The local bubble is an underdense region of gas, dust, and stars. There's no big stars in the local bubble. And the stars are far apart. There's not much gas or dust. And so that means that we're in an unusually radiation-free environment in our Milky Way galaxy. And then to cap it all off, our sun and its planets entered a region in the middle of that local bubble called the local fluff. So this is the local fluff inside the local bubble. And what's this local fluff? It's basically a lot of compressed gas and dust, which has the effect of blocking out cosmic radiation and also shrinking the heliosphere of our sun and compressing its atmosphere. So it simultaneously minimizes cosmic radiation and solar radiation. Say, when did we enter that? Well, about 200,000 years ago, the sun came into one side of the local fluff. As you can see right now, it's almost dead center in the local fluff. Another 100,000 years, it will exit, which means we happen to be in a narrow time window, about 100,000 years wide, where our exposure to cancer-causing radiation has never been lower at any time, anywhere in the history of the entire universe. And to cap it all off, the sun also entered an extremely radiation-safe environment. This actually shows you the luminosity stability of the sun at the top and the bottom, the luminosity stability of the second most stable star in our Milky Way galaxy. So we're orbiting a star that's 5 times more stable than any other star in our Milky Way galaxy. And in terms of cancer-causing radiation, look where we are right now. We're living at the time when our sun is causing the least amount of cancer radiation in its entire history. And you won't have to wait long before that changes. Eventually, we're going to move out and be exposed to more radiation. So literally, God put us here on planet Earth in the best possible location of the universe in our Milky Way galaxy and put us here at the best possible time. And finally, he designed our human bodies to be the least cancer-averse of any mammal or bird on the planet. So our bodies have been designed to be exceptionally cancer-free. Now, how many of you have ever had a pet dog or a cat? Okay. How many of you have had a pet dog or cat that had its life terminated by cancer? Okay. That's happened to 5 of my pets. And so, you know, 10, 15, 12, 18 years, they wind up dying of cancer. Okay. But we humans are different. For all animals except humans, the cancer risk rises with the total number of heartbeats. So, for example, there are turtles that live 200 years, and they don't get cancer. But what's typical of animals is the more heartbeats they have, the greater the risk that they're going to get cancer. The exception is human beings. Now, in terms of lifespan, you shouldn't be counting your lifespan in terms of years that you live. There's sharks that live to be 500 years, turtles that live to be 200 or 300 years. But when you say live, they don't do much. We humans are the longest living species on planet Earth if you count our lifespan and how many heartbeats you experience. That's significant because the number of heartbeats you experienced in your life determines how much you're able to accomplish. So turtles, because they got a very low heart rate, they don't do much. They spend a lot of time here on planet Earth, but they don't get to do much. We're only here for 80 years or so, but look at all we can do in our 70, 80, or 90 years. Humans, on average, experience 4 times as many heartbeats during their life as any other animal on planet Earth. And yet, the heart rate determines your cancer rate. We are an exception. Our bodies are amazingly designed that we can have a lot of heartbeats and not get cancer until we're old in age. Now, something also has been recently discovered. Is you'd say, well, if God really wanted us not to have to deal with cancer, couldn't he eliminate all the radiation? If you eliminate all the radiation, the cancer rate skyrockets. You have to be exposed to just the right level of radiation to minimize cancer. Now, if you get exposed to a lot of solar radiation and cosmic radiation, your chances of dying from cancer go up, and they go up significantly. But if you take all the radiation out, your cancer risk also goes up. They determined this by doing experiments on other mammals. And so what they did is they took mice and rats and other animals, and they fed them a radiation-free diet. You say, well, how do you do that? Okay. The biggest consumption of radiation is potassium-40, okay? Because there's a lot of potassium in the bodies of all birds and mammals. And most of it's potassium-39, which is not radioactive. But a significant amount, a fraction of a percent, is potassium-40, which is radioactive. And it decays, its half-life is about 1.3 billion years. And what they discovered is that it's actually possible to treat food and pull all the radioactive potassium out. And so they did that with animal experiments, and so they were eating a diet with no potassium-40 in it. And what they discovered? The cancer rate went way up. And so they said, well, let's actually experiment. Let's put less potassium-40. They tried zero, less than what we normally expose to. Then they doubled it and tripled it. And what they discovered is cancer rate is minimized if you don't mess with the potassium-40. Just leave it at the natural level. If you leave it at the natural level. And they discovered why. Exposure to a small amount of radiation actually stimulates DNA repair in all of our cells. And if you take away all the radiation, then the cells stop functioning. They stop performing DNA repair. And it's fairly aggressive DNA repair that's your best check against cancer. Now, I did a survey at the beginning of this class. How many of you have ever had to deal with cancer? A few of you put up your hands, about a quarter of you. The truth is, all of you have had to deal with cancer. Now, you don't notice it because the DNA repair in your cells takes care of the cancer before anybody can even detect it. So even little children are actually dealing with cancer. It's when our cells no longer have the DNA repair capability that you wind up getting cancer serious enough that it alerts the attention of your medical practitioners. And so it takes a minimum exposure to radiation for our cells to sustain the DNA repair operations that are necessary to prevent cancer from becoming a significant health issue. Animals fed a potassium-40-free diet die from cancer at a far greater rate. The present level that we're exposed to is optimal. Now, the potassium-40 level is not constant. It's been changing over time. So this is the decay of potassium-40 over the age of the Earth. And so it's been getting less and less and less. And so if we were put here, say, a half billion years ago, we'd be exposed to so much potassium-40, there's no way any of us could live 60 or 70 years. Potassium-40 has declined sufficiently, we can now live 80, 90 years, 100 years. And in the future, potassium-40 will drop to such a low level that no longer will we be able to live 70, 80, 90, or 100 years. And finally, this is the last thing. Our cells are actually designed to minimize the cancer rate, and the way they do that is, in addition to ensuring the DNA repair is optimal, they make sure the telomeres get shorter and shorter in our DNA. And say, what are telomeres? They're basically little aglets at each end of your DNA. I want to know, like, an aglet is like your shoelace, where you've got this little plastic thing that ensures that it doesn't unravel. Our DNA is the same. It's got things at the end of each DNA strand that actually preserves the length of the strand. But our body's designed that the older we get, the shorter and shorter our chromosomes become. Now you say, well, why would God do that? Well, it's the shortening of the chromosomes that actually ensures you don't get cancer when you're 10, 15, 20 years of age, or at least very few of us do. So if the shortening was less aggressive, then we'd be dying earlier from cancer. And if you make it more aggressive, you'd die earlier from old age. Because, hey, if you're shortening your chromosomes, that means all your cells are wearing out. And so you got a choice. Do you want to die of old age, or do you want to die of cancer? Basically, our telomere shortening is optimized so that, you know, we get to live as long as possible. And the other thing is, in terms of cancer, the people that are at risk are the healthy people living a healthy lifestyle. Now, again, there are exceptions. The laws of thermodynamics ensure that there will be a tiny fraction of people that are 3 years of age or 5 years of age that get cancer. That's just the way thermodynamics works. But it's a very tiny number. So for the population as a whole, only people with a high living standard, access to excellent preventive health care, who take responsibility to maintain their health through regular physical and mental exercise. By the way, they've now discovered regular mental exercise helps minimize your risk for cancer. So it's not just your physical exercise, it's your mental exercise. And I joke that, hey, come to Paradoxes because you'll get some mental exercise. And you need a healthy diet, a low body mass index, and if that's the case, your risk of dying from cancer is higher than the rest of the population, simply because you're likely to live a lot longer. And so, you know, most people die from heart disease, but if you've got really good health care and you've got a healthy living style, then chances are heart disease is not going to take you out. Diabetes is not going to take you out. You're going to live long enough for something else to take you out. And by the way, we all get taken out, right? So, but the whole idea is we want to serve the Lord with all of our heart and mind, for as long and as active as possible. And God has actually designed the universe in such a way that cancer is minimized to a level to make that possible. Hey, if you want to read more, it's in the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And hey, I've gone 45 minutes, not counting those stories I told at the beginning. So we'll take Q&A. And as always, we'll alternate between people that are here in person and people that are participating with us through live streaming online. But it sounds like we got a live stream question to start things off.
If you have a question, just come back here and line up and we'll alternate. Tenny W, hi Dr. Ross, Proverbs 6:10 warns against a little slumber. How do you balance that verse with the benefit of power naps?
Okay. This really doesn't have much to do with cancer. It does have a lot to do with maintaining your mental acuity. And that passage in Proverbs 6 is basically saying, too much sleep is not good for you. Too little sleep is also not good for you. And I know there are people today who say, hey, I only get 4 hours of sleep a night, but I take power naps. Well, research shows that you're probably better off getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep and maybe taking a short nap. It's also true that the older you get, the less sleep you need. But here's a caveat. The older you get, the less sleep you need if you're not engaged in regular, strenuous mental and physical exercise. If you maintain regular, strenuous mental and physical exercise, the older you get, the more sleep you need. And so if you're my age or approaching my age, you might want to complement your sleep with some, quote, power naps. Because, hey, if you're active, you're probably going to need more sleep. But it is true, if you sleep too much, it does cause problems. Too little sleep, too much sleep begins to damage the brain and other organs. So that, too, needs to be optimized.
Hi, Dr. Ross. So thank you. I've always heard that if you live long enough, you'll get cancer. So now I can see that you're healthy and you get cancer, which is so weird. But all of these things still don't make sense, because if God was so great and is so great, I still don't understand why he didn't create everything perfect so that we wouldn't even get cancer or have the evil. I don't even understand why we have evil. And if everything was perfect, why did he create these bad things?
A very good question, and what's unique about Christianity, unlike other religions, it's a two-creation model. God creates his universe as a tool in his hand to eradicate all evil and suffering. And once all evil and suffering are eradicated, then he takes us into the new creation where cancer will never be an issue for the rest of eternity. Nothing will decay, nothing will die, nothing will cause you grief, nothing will cause you any pain, or any tears. That's the new creation. Now, you say, and what you notice in Genesis chapter 1, the present creation is referred to as very good. It's not referred to as perfect. The perfect creation is yet to come. We don't get the perfect creation until evil is eradicated once and for all. Now, one pushback to that is, well, couldn't have God created things so that we never got exposed to evil? Well, that's the interesting thing you see about Genesis 2 and 3. You've got Adam and Eve in paradise, and what does God do? He invites Satan, the author of evil, to come into the Garden of Eden and to test Adam and Eve. You say, couldn't God have just kept Satan and all of his demons out of planet Earth for the rest of eternity, so we never get exposed to this problem of evil? Well, one thing that Adam and Eve lacked, that followers of Jesus Christ today possess, they lacked eternal security. Their free will, God purposely gave them a free will because God wanted to have strong love relationships with his creatures, which meant that their free will was strong enough that they could rebel against him. And yes, by allowing Satan in the Garden of Eden, the most intelligent and powerful creature that God made, Adam and Eve got exposed to a test that they weren't strong enough to pass on their own strength. But here's the principle. It gave them a pathway to eternal security. When you get exposed to the most challenging test possible in the context of evil and pass that test, there's no other test that could ever tempt you to do evil for the rest of eternity. An analogy I use in why the universe is the way it is that I have a PhD in astrophysics, and because of the rigor I went through to get that PhD, I never again have to be tested for my competency in astrophysics, based on the belief I've already passed the most difficult tests, so it's pointless to test me again. Likewise, God ensures that every human being gets exposed to the most challenging tests. All of us get tested by Satan. An example of that is what you see in the book of Revelation. It says a time will come when God will lock up Satan in a prison for 1,000 years. But during that 1,000 years, children are born. Children are born that get to see Jesus ruling in downtown Jerusalem every day on their high-tech devices. The economy is perfect. They got great health. People are living much longer than they live right now. Even carnivorous activity is eliminated. God in the millennium eliminates every excuse we humans have for why we sin, except the real one. He said, well, Satan made me do it. Hey, I got the guy locked up. You can't blame him anymore. But what does God do at the end of that 1,000 years? He releases Satan to test the children born during that 1,000-year period. And what does the text tell us? The majority of those children will choose to rebel against Jesus Christ. Basically making the point, the real reason why we sin is because of the wickedness of our human heart. Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10. You can't blame external circumstances. It also makes the point, no one can pass the test of being exposed to Satan unless we go to God and ask him to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And it's because we get exposed to that most challenging test, and through God's help pass that most challenging test, we get something Adam and Eve never had. We get eternal security. So that's the reason why there's two creations. That's the reason why it's essential we be exposed to risk of cancer and heart disease, diabetes, and all kinds of other health issues today. Because God's in the business of eradicating evil and at the same time suffering once and for all. So it's the same message I say to my students is, hey, you only have to suffer at my hand for 4 months. After that, the suffering is gone, and you'll be prepared for a career. Likewise, God is saying in John 16, 33, in this world you'll have tribulation, but you only get exposed to the tribulation for a few decades, with a promise you get to enter a new creation where there'll be no more tribulation for the rest of eternity. Was I responsive to your question?
Well, I still don't understand, why do we have to do that? If God can do anything, why did he have to even make us go through a test?
Well, he could do anything. However, to do what you ask, he would have to give us a weaker free will. I mean, as it is, the Bible tells us about 2/3 of all human beings will say no thank you to the generous offer God is giving us. And that's because God created each of us with a very strong free will. He could have given us a weak free will, or maybe only 1% of us rebel against his authority. 99% would get to enter the new creation. But we would be entering the new creation with a weak free will. God's desire is that we would have strong love relationships require that we be endowed with strong free will. And because God has such a high value on love, he was willing to take the risk that a majority of us would say, no thanks, because he realizes there's going to be a huge reward in the 1/3 that say, I want this eternal relationship with a being that is all love, truth, and life.
Okay, here's one, Hugh. What are the best explanations given by skeptical scientists for the Cambrian explosion? What are your answers to them? There's one more question, I'll wait.
Okay, well, in terms of the Cameron explosion, I've addressed that in my book, Improbable Planet, basically saying there's been a paradigm shift on the Cameron explosion. You know, when I was studying the Cameron explosion as a high school student and as an undergraduate, I was taught that these Cambrian phyla, and you say, what's a phyla? It's a basic body plan. So, for example, all of us human beings are part of the chordate phylum, which means we're part of that collection of animals that has a long neural cord. And we happen to be vertebrates. And so every vertebrate is a chordate. But there's also chordates that don't have a backbone, but they've got that long spinal or neural cord that helps all their internal organs to function at a high level. I was taught 50, 60 years ago that the different Cambrian phyla went from the very simplest phyla at the beginning of the Cambrian to the most complex 50 million years at the end of the Cambrian. What's happened in the scientific community is they now recognize that's not the way it works. All the phyla show up at the beginning of the Cambrian, including the most complex, including even vertebrates. They've now found fish with backbones that appear at the very beginning of the Cambrian explosion. And I think what really caused things to turn around, and this was led by James Valentine's research team. He's a paleontologist, describes himself as an atheist, but he and his team have written papers saying, okay, if the Cambrian explosion is a naturalistic explanation, that would mean that you've got mutations, natural selection, gene exchange, and epigenetics causing a proliferation of species. And if you wait long enough, that proliferation of species actually creates a new genus. And if you wait long enough, the proliferation of genera will produce a new family. If you wait long enough, the new families will give you new orders, the orders new classes. Last of all, you get the proliferation of phyla. What Valentine's team has pointed out, however, when you study the Cambrian explosion, you notice that you get the proliferation of phyla first, the proliferation of species last of all. What we see in the Cambrian explosion, you get the proliferation of phyla first, then classes, then orders, then families. It's the exact opposite of what you'd expect from a naturalistic perspective, but is exactly what you'd expect if God is the author of all life on planet Earth. Because God, after all, would be aggressively creating life to prepare our planet as rapidly as possible for human beings. Now, people say 3.8 billion years is not very rapid. In terms of what's necessary to get a large human population with high technology civilization, 3.8 billion years is extremely aggressive. It's a miracle. Many miracles have to be performed to get that to happen that quickly. And so in that context, you'd expect that the Creator would produce all these phyla. Now, what I've added in the book Design to the Core, so we now notice these phyla show up the very instant the oxygen reaches the minimum level to support those phyla. There's no time delay. The moment oxygen hits 10%, you immediately have the Cambrian explosion. The moment it hits 8%, you immediately have the Avalon explosion. From a naturalistic perspective, you'd anticipate a significant time delay. We see no time delays at all. The Cambrian phyla show up simultaneously, instantly, at the very beginning of the Cambrian event. And if you read Improbable Planet, I quote from seven different paleontologists and geneticists where they're basically saying that the more we study the Cambrian explosion, the more impossible it is to sustain a naturalistic interpretation. Materialism is not compatible with either the Cambrian or Avalon explosions. What's the follow-up?
Oh, the follow-up was, I hear there's, you might be speaking in Nebraska, when and where?
I'll be speaking in Nebraska within a few days. I'm getting on an airplane on Wednesday, going to Kansas first, and I think it's this weekend, next weekend, I'll be speaking at a mega church in Omaha, Nebraska. All the details are up on the website at reasons.org. Just look under events.
Jamie, do we have more time? Or are we out of time?
One
more. A little more question? Come on up.
Hi. It's very simple. What would be the explanation for the amount of childhood cancer?
Okay, explanation for childhood cancer. Yeah, that's a good one because I get that all the time from atheists on my social media. If there's a God, why is there childhood cancer? Well, here's the answer. In order to eradicate all evil, you need thermodynamics. You need electromagnetism. You need gravity. Well, especially with thermodynamics and electromagnetism, there's a randomness to it. I mean, we're taught that when we take classes on thermodynamics, is that there's a random nature to the thermodynamics. I mean, for example, some people's backyards decay at a more rapid rate than other people's backyards. Now, the thing we note about childhood cancer, it's rare compared to adult cancer. It does happen, but it's at a very low incident level. I mean, it is true, the older you are, the more likely you are to suffer from cancer. But because of thermodynamics, it can even happen to newborn babies. Extremely rare, but it does happen. Now, I happen to know, in fact, there were some pediatrician cancer researchers at this lecture I gave in India a year ago. And they said, the interesting thing about childhood cancer is that it's much easier to detect than adult cancer. And so we're able to treat it more effectively. But it's still true that there are children that die from cancer. But they're much more likely to die from falling off their tricycle going down a hill. And again, God could eliminate all childhood cancer simply by eliminating thermodynamics. But if he did that, we'd be stuck on our sin. And so God is far more concerned about spiritual cancer than he is physical cancer.
Come on, Ted.
All right, Dr. Ross. Your plot of solar luminosity made me remember a podcast I'd listened to. By the way, the two plots had no numbers on them, and I'll trust you that you had the same scale on both plots, correct?
No. The scale of the luminosity stability is linear. That one where I showed the sun dipping down like that, it's logarithmic. The first one, completely linear. The second one, the radiation levels when the sun is, say, less than 500 million years old, is about 10,000 to 100,000 times greater than it is today.
So the difference is even more pronounced than it appears.
Way more pronounced, yes, okay. By orders of magnitude.
Thank you. So that plot made me think of a podcast I recently listened to featuring Stephen Meyer and James Tour. And I believe you're largely in agreement with them.
I know both gentlemen,
of course.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So they did touch on the subject of our sun. And if you listen to popular scientific discussions, you'll hear the assertion that our sun is nothing special. It's very plain vanilla. Nothing out of the ordinary. And I think I heard the same from those two gentlemen. So how widely held is your opinion that it's really quite unique? And why is that not the majority opinion?
Right. That's common knowledge amongst astrophysicists, especially solar astrophysicists. I'm not surprised that Jim Tour and Stephen Meyer weren't aware of that science. But you'll find a whole chapter on the sun plus an appendix in the book Design to the Core where I say, yeah, there's no other star like the sun by a wide margin. And one of the most astounding new things that have been discovered about the sun, it's the only star that's got big rocky planets orbiting distantly from the star. We're now finding hundreds of rocky planets orbiting other stars. What we notice is they're not as massive as the rocky planets in the solar system, and they orbit way closer. Almost all of them, I think there's only one that orbits outside the orbit of Mercury. All the rest are way inside the orbit of Mercury, and the one that is outside is barely outside. So it's still true today, even though we now have 7,000 planets discovered outside of our solar system, the most Earth-like planet we've found so far is Venus. Nothing that we've discovered comes close to Venus in matching the properties of the Earth and what's been discovered by the Sun. The reason why it has these massive rocky planets orbiting so far away from our Sun is that it transferred a lot of refractory elements from the star to the rocky planets. It also transferred a lot of angular momentum. And for that to happen, you need extremely exquisite fine-tuning. And we don't know of any other star who has those fine-tuned characteristics. And if that weren't the case, if we were orbiting any closer, we couldn't exist. That's also true if we were orbiting any farther, we couldn't exist. And it's also crucial that we'd be on a big rocky planet with a very high density. It's one of the unique features of the Earth. It's a huge rocky planet with a very thin atmosphere, thin layer of water, and an extremely high density. So, and that's all because of how the Sun transferred heavy metals and angular momentum from the star out to its rocky planets.
When you expand the scope of consideration to the whole solar system, that adds to your argument that the Sun is unique.
Yes, yes. I mean, for example, for the past 65 years, astronomers have been scouring our Milky Way galaxy, looking for a twin of the Sun. A star sufficiently like the Sun, it could be a candidate of a planet orbiting it on which advanced life is possible. That 65-year search has produced zero solar twins. Millions of stars have been surveyed. Not one of them is a solar twin. Many of them are twins of one another, but the Sun has no twin. Now, I think just to be fair to Jim Tuer and Steve Meyer, it is true that the mass of our star is not special. It's basically a small star. There are many stars way bigger, stars that are smaller. So it's ordinary in the sense that there's nothing special about its mass. But every other characteristic of the Sun is really super special.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Ross, for this series, and we are out of time, so please close us in prayer.
Be happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you that we live in the 21st century where we're learning so much from your book of nature and learning so much that is pointing us to your book of scripture. I pray, Father, that you would encourage us to be students of both of your books, the book of nature and the book of scripture, and integrating them, we'd be equipped to share what you've revealed with people who don't yet know you as Creator, Lord, and Savior, that they too may enter into the new creation with an eternally secure and loving relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.